Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Grant Kruger, and I'm very excited to be here with you this Wednesday, September 11th. September 11th is obviously a very solemn day in Tucson and United States history, and I would be remiss to not talk about that just a little bit, right? This happens to be one of those black swan events where everybody remembers where they were at, what was happening on that exact moment 23 years ago. And I think a lot about a good friend of mine named Tom Keeling, who happened to be a New York firefighter. And more than half of his battalion was killed in 9/11. And he spent the subsequent weeks after the attack cleaning up after the Trade Center. I met Tom in Mexico about 20 years ago because he was retired with what they call Trade Center lung. And Trade Center lung happens from breathing in the pulverized dust and concrete and steel from the collapse of the towers, reducing his breathing capacity by about 60% for the rest of his life. And so Tom ultimately was able to receive a settlement from the United States government and the Trade Center Fund and retire. But quite frankly, this is a really tough guy, right? A Bronx, New York City firefighter, flat top, New York accent. And when we talk about 9/11, it can bring a gentleman like this to tears over that tragedy. And when I try to think of 9/11, I think of not the tragedies like what happened to Tom Keeling and his battalion so much, but the unity of what happened in the United States, what happened in America post 9/11. If you guys remember, on the 15th of September, we had over 10,000 people show up to Tucson Electric Park and make this amazing human flag. And suddenly political parties became not so important, and we were unified together as Americans. And when I think of the animosity that we saw in America even last night, it reminds me of where we could actually be as a country and as a society, that quite frankly, we should be proud to be Americans, to be lucky to be in this culture that we have today and take advantage of that situation rather than having such divisiveness. Perhaps, unfortunately, we need some other black swan event to bring us together. I remember where I was when Kennedy was shot, or when the Challenger exploded, or 9/11 or something like that. And it's sad to think that we need something like this to actually unify us as Americans. On Food for Thought today, there's another date that pops up on September 11th that may not be as important to you listeners, but is very important to us restaurateurs here in Southern Arizona. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced their annual inflation numbers at 5:30 a.m. this morning. Now, you guys don't get so excited about this on Jump in Tucson, but quite frankly, these numbers reflect what Arizona's minimum wage is going to be on January 1st, 2025. And so those numbers came out this morning as I eagerly woke up, pounding my first cup of filthy pirate coffee to take a peek at this one. And they're calling for an inflation increase of 2.5%. That's down from last year's 3.7%, and even further down from the previous year's 8.3%. But what that means is that Arizona's minimum wage is going to go up to $14.70 an hour. What that also means is that the city of Tucson's minimum wage, which has been tied to set dollar amounts based on a ballot initiative from a few years ago, will go to $15 an hour. And so for the first time in the last 3 years, we're going to have a differential wage between the city of Tucson and unincorporated Pima County. Last week on Jump in Tucson, we talked about a differential tax rate between the city of Tucson and Pima County. And if the city of Tucson gets their way, they might have a 9.2% tax rate compared to Pima County's 6.1% tax rate, 50% more, right? And now we're talking about having a higher minimum wage inside the city of Tucson as well. Years ago, when I fought Proposition 206, which was the initiative to make Arizona's minimum wage tied to inflation so that it would tick up in perpetuity, I had the camera from KVOA and other press organizations in my face. And I told them, I said, this fight for 15, guys, is going to cause a $15 hamburger. and people mocked and laughed at me. I was ridiculed on Facebook, right? You're a terrible person. You don't care about your employees' interests. And now, looking at the price of a hamburger, noting that the fight for 15 has essentially been won by the left. On January 1st in Tucson, we will have the $15 an hour minimum wage. However, I did a little research for you listeners over here and looked at the current hamburger prices of a few local restaurants that you might note. And so a burger with fries currently at the Parish is now $19. A burger with fries at Cold Beer and Cheeseburgers is $18.45. If you go to Trueland Burger and get a burger with fries, it's $19.95. And that's before this minimum wage is going up over here. So I hate to Monday morning quarterback and say I was right, because obviously in the long term, prices of course are going to go up. But in this case, they've gone up substantially. That $15 hamburger comment was a laughingstock in 2016, 2017, and now look at us, right? And so, like, when we look at these things that we're doing inside of the city of Tucson, we have to think about, like, ways that we're going to attract businesses. If you look at Karen Ulick's statement yesterday, she asked to put on the city of Tucson's agenda looking at smoke shops, hookah lounges, right? And ways that the city might regulate those more. And while certainly I can say that we are having some problems with some of the hookah lounges in what have become this new third place for some of our youth, the answer, as it always is, my listeners, is not more government. It's actually less government regulation. Quite frankly, our higher minimum wages in the city of Tucson, our high regulatory oversight prevents additional businesses from opening up. The reason you don't have 24-hour diners anymore is because of minimum wages like this. These could have been far safer and more effective third places, as they like to stay in Starbucks, for our youth to hang out in the evenings rather than having to hang out in a hookah lounge, which doesn't have the same labor cost as a grill or some sort of 24-hour, you know, Chaffin's diner type concept or a welcome diner. These things barely exist anymore, quite frankly, because of the higher regulations that we have. And we've got a tax vote coming up for even more taxes in the city of Tucson. When we come back after the break, though, we are going to talk a little bit more politics today on Jump in Tucson. I've got former House Representative, former State Senator, and running candidate for the current Republican candidate for Legislative District 17, Senator Vince Leach, coming up after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us. People ask me all the time, like, what is this intersection between restaurants and politics, Grant? And why are you always talking about both and bringing them in there? Well, quite frankly, restaurants happen to be one of the most highly regulated industries in both the state, the county, or the city. And so today, we've got the pleasure of having live in studio Republican Legislative District candidate for Senate 17, Vince Leach. Good morning, Vince.
Good morning.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us on Jump in Tucson.
Great to be here.
Hey, we're excited to have you this morning. Why don't you break down a little bit about your political history for our listeners that don't know who you are?
Well, I came to Arizona. Well, actually, our first trip to Arizona was in 92. I fell in love with Brown. I fell in love with the mountains. Not so my wife. We came from the Midwest. She liked the green. And it took me many, many years and new furniture in the house, maybe a little bit of jewelry. But in 2007, she said, okay, we need to go to Arizona. And so we moved to Arizona. Never have looked back. It's we loved it. I just love the weather. I love the scenery. And if once you've been here and you experienced the life that the life cycle that a desert goes through, it's pretty amazing. So we love it. We did find out that there is a cycle because we always have allergies to something. We didn't have them till we came here. But no, we love it. It's good. It's been good to us.
So you've been heavily involved in politics over the last decade or so, serving both in the House and the Senate, you know, a couple of very important seats in Arizona's legislature. Where did you get that seed for politics? Where did that start?
Well, it started really many, many years ago. My stepfather, his former wife was the National Democratic Committee Woman in Wisconsin. They were divorced. My mom was divorced, and my mom and this gentleman remarried. And so politics was something that you did around the dinner table every night. I mean, you talked about who was in it. I mean, name these names. Proxmire, for those that remember Proxmire, Proxmire slept in our house. Henry Royce, which is a big name in Wisconsin politics, slept in our house. I mean, that was just the way it was. And so there were a lot of discussions about that. I went on to college. I thought I was going to be this fantastic biology person. And I was good until I ran in the second semester of chemistry. I could tell what it was, but when they said, how much is there of it? I said, who knows and who cares?
Those are the weeder courses, if I remember from my days at the University of Arizona here.
So I said, if you get me out of this course, I'm going to go across. And I had this love for poli sci, political science, and history. And so that's where I ended up. And then we came out here. I won a draft lottery. I was number 47 in the first draft lottery. So I went in, did my military time, came out here, and after my work time, I came out here, and I actually got involved with politics over something that was very, very harmful to many Arizonans, and that was a total and absolute collapse of the Baptist Foundation in the late 90s. It was a Ponzi scheme. It wasn't really connected with the Baptist Church, but it was a Ponzi scheme, golf courses and whatever, and it went bad. As a result of that, the Corporation Commission and the legislature didn't see it coming, and they got together and said, make sure this never happens again. Well, the resultant was that they had a bill that didn't preclude people like you and me investing in houses of worship, but it took 16 weeks to get a bond through. Well, bonds don't last that long. And so I came to Arizona, and I had a retirement check. That was, I had started church bonds back in Wisconsin, and they were a good vehicle. And I came out here, and I couldn't buy them because they weren't sold in this state because of the limitations. I said, I can't live with that. So Al Melvin, God rest his soul, was a senator, so we started working on it. I failed in 2009. I failed in 2010. But by then, I learned the lay of the land. I knew the people, knew the people in the House, knew the people in the Senate, knew the staffers, knew the lobbyists. And on April 21st of 2011, the governor signed a bill allowing normal people to invest in churches of worship. And so that's where it got started here. I was also involved in a Board of Education meeting up in Oracle, an overpriced bond package for something that they didn't need. And then we also worked at Pinell County taxes to try to get them lowered. It was very hard to sell that program because most people coming from California or New York or Illinois were paying $12,000, $13,000, $15,000 property taxes. And when you say the taxes are going from $2,600 to $2,700,
not quite as impactful.
No. They said, "Get out of here. This is nothing." You know, I spill that much. That's an accounting, that's a rounding error in my checkbook. But we did get it through. That took us 3 years. Then in 2013, Senator Melvin decided he was going to run for governor. Adam Quasman was going to run for Congress. Steve Smith, who was in the House, I knew he would want to come back to the Senate. And so all of a sudden we had two open House seats. And you know, I thought about it, and finally I made a decision, and then I got to go to the chairman of the board, and that was my wife. And I'll never forget, we were coming down Oracle. We live in Saddlebrook. Coming down Oracle, I asked before Rancho Vistoso, I said, I think I'm going to run. We went through that stoplight. We went through Tangerine, got way down past First, and we're going past El Conquistador, and I looked over at her. My hands are white on the steering wheel, and she said, you might as well. You're working on all this other stuff up there. you might as well get into it. And so that was my entry in. And then I had, I served 4 years in the House, 2 elections, 4 years in the House, and then went over to the Senate. All those years, I was on Appropriations, Vice Chair of Appropriations, a very key spot, and 6 years, four in the Senate and two in the House on Ways and Means. Those are just fancy words for how we take money from you. By the way, you don't give money to the government. They take it. And if you don't think they take it, just don't pay it sometime. They will take it.
And then sage advice indeed there, sir.
And then appropriations. And appropriations is more than just allotting that money to various functions. You get a total picture of how the state runs and where you're putting your money. If you're putting it into K-12, if you're putting it into our access program, Medicaid, if you're putting it into jails, our prison system, or other programs on down the line. I remember one of the things that Senator Gowen and I worked on one of the last years was the Arizona Trail. They were looking, not a lot of money, but they were looking for money, and we were able to help them out. So that's how it all happened. That's where I got. And then a funny thing happened on the way to the election in 22. It's called redistricting. And so the district that I was well known in, Oro Valley, Marana, Saddlebrook Ranch, on up to the city of Maricopa.
That was the previous legislative district 11, if I remember correctly?
District 11, yes, sir. That was changed more than a little bit. All of a sudden, I didn't go any further north than Saddlebrook Ranch, but I picked up Tanga Verde and I picked up Vail. Had about 5 days to make myself known down there before early ballots because we were in session, and I lost that election. That was a three-way election, by the way.
I was going to bring that up. That election loss as well 2 years ago was splitting the Republican votes three ways. Primary over there.
Yeah, and the two that we defeated took 60% of the vote. So the person that won that race won with 40%. I don't know what that says. I'm not into all those number crunching, but 60% of the vote for two people that didn't get in, 40% for the incumbent.
Well, it creates a lot of animosity sometimes when you look at, say, these Republican primaries, right? And do you primary an incumbent or not? And certainly, like, this happened to be one of the hottest races, I think, not just in southern Arizona, but potentially the state as well, too, given the delicate balance that exists right now between both legislative bodies, with both the Senate and the House having only a one-seat Republican lead as well, too.
You know, Grant, there were a lot of decisions that I had to go through in making the decisions to run again, not the least of which is you look at the margin that the Republican won the 22 election over the Democrat. That was 2 percentage points.
That was Justine Wadsack against Mike Nickerson, if I remember
Mike
correctly.
Nickerson. Mike Nickerson was a very well-liked gentleman. Not known. No money from, as far as we can tell, no money from the state Democrat Party. But very, people liked him. And that's obvious in the vote count. So you look at that spread, 2%, but you have a 9% spread Republican advantage over Democrats. And so that victory, by all rights, should have been a greater victory. 4 points, 5 points at least, if not 8 or 9. That you tuck that away and say, well, that's that situation. And then you look at some of the things that happened when I left. My last budget created a
our
budget created a $2.5 billion surplus, a billion. It's a billion with a B. The first budget after I was gone in 23, it was applied to 2024 budget, caused a $1.8 billion shortfall. That fired me up. That the use of that money, where they simply gave every sitting senator $30 million and every sitting Republican, and every sitting Republican House member, $20 million to spend as you want, is not the way to run a budget at the state.
Without a doubt. Well, you're sitting pretty now as the Republican candidate, having most recently won that primary. You've got an election coming up on November 5th. We've got a couple more segments coming up with Senate candidate Vince Leach from Legislative District 17. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on 1030 AM The Voice, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. Thanks again for spending this part of your Wednesday with us. Every week on Jump in Tucson, we've got a different host on Thursdays. We bring you Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance. On Friday, we've got Dr. Ed Ackerley, who brings up all kinds of neat things happening at the U of A, or U Arizona, if they're still calling it that. And then, of course, on Tuesdays, we've got Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council as well. But this morning, we've got a couple more segments with Vince Leach, the Senate candidate for Legislative District 17. Welcome back, Vince.
Good to be back.
Hey, we were talking all things government and these races that you had, you know, a somewhat contemptuous primary that you just went through just this last July 31st, where you were victorious with about 52% to 48% vote. So this one was pretty close. Like, where do you think that rift comes on the Republican Party side?
Well, we have a division in the party. I think we saw it coming. We saw it coming way back when John McCain was running for president. We saw some kind of a split, but we were able to manage through it. And then the Patriot Party was born somewhere, somehow. I'm not a part of the Patriot Party, but it was born, and they had an idea that was. They've published. A treatise that said, you know, they want to replace all the things that they think are bad, that not necessarily bad for Americans, but they think they're bad, and they want to just wipe everything clean. And they think everything, well, I don't want to guess what they think as far as all the policies that have gone through. They would like to cut spending, but we would all like to cut spending. The problem with getting into cutting spending is when you have, before COVID, we had 300 people moving to Arizona a day, and we were putting them to work. Our unemployment wasn't going up. They weren't all retired folks. That we were putting people to work. Our economy was growing. When you have a growing economy and you have people coming here, you need things. You need infrastructure. You need things that government is supposed to provide, and that takes money. And so, Ed, I'll never forget, we were sitting in a budget meeting, and we had a budget amount out for ADOT, Arizona Department of Transportation, for blacktop, for a job. They came back, ADOT did, and said, we've just had a 46% increase in the cost of blacktop. And you talked a little bit about it in your opening segment, the cost of inflation that goes up. And that gets related back to your tax statement. And government gets blamed for that. But it's,
Well, what do you think, Vince, we could do to heal that division that permeates the Republican Party? Because you were looking at a group, particularly in Southern Arizona, that outside of Legislative District 17 is severely outnumbered, right? I live in LD 18, and let me tell you, like, that is not a competitive district. I think it's a D plus 22 there. And so the Republicans are bringing a knife to a gunfight in voter registration to begin with. Even if we were all unified and divided, I fear that it's actually worse than that. Like, what do you think we could do to fix that?
So for, golly, for 17 years, I've been walking into Republican meetings and sometimes Republican and Democrat meeting. You can look at the Republican side and you can ask on an issue. And if you have 20 people there, you will get 21 answers of how you should do it. On the Democrat side, and sometimes they get mad when I say this, and you know it's the Democrat side because they all have the same T-shirts on, right? They all have Bernie Sanders. They're all white, all same. back, lockstep. On our side, we're all genuine thinkers. We think for ourselves, and we tend not to follow the crowd. And so my way is better than your way. And you know what? If you don't believe me, and if you don't take my way, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. And you know what? I'm not going to go to your daughter's wedding. And furthermore, I'm not going to go to the wake. That I've seen splits like that.
This is part of the problem, I think, that we have with the party here. And this goes beyond, of course, just Southern Arizona.
Oh,
this
yeah.
exists
oh,
on
yeah,
a state
yeah.
and national level. But we're out there looking at moderate Republicans who are trying to reach across the aisle and get things done, such as, say, Juan Ciscomani. And then the rhino cries come in and say, you're not conservative enough. But perhaps if you come from a legislative district that is balanced, you want your candidate to reflect their constituency.
If you want Republican, you have to look at each particular district. That's something you, as soon as you go up to Phoenix, you learn that there are certain districts that you can't push very hard because they are a very tight district. There are certain districts like a Gosar district on the congressional side, a plus what, 48-55.
Correct. As long as you win the Republican primary there, you're safe.
Yeah, that race is done. We have some races like that. You know, Senator Gowin, he would really have to fall off the log really, really bad and far to lose that race down there just because of the spread R's and D's. And so, but then it's the close in districts, and that's forced a little bit, more than a little bit, a lot, by the Redistricting Commission, because they're trying to, the Republicans on the commission are trying to get as many Republican seats as they can, and the Democrats are pushing back.
Logically.
And that's where you get all these splits, and that's where you get these crazy, crazy lines. I mean, LD-17, you know, Marana, Oro Valley, you go up Mount Lemmon, and you make a hard right, and you come all the way down through. And so who made that up? Well, one of the commissioners wanted to have a Republican-centric district in southern Arizona. Do you know, right now, this will change over time. Right now, there is not a Republican elected that lives in Pima County. LD-19 lives out, and I live out. Now, we have Corey and we have Rachel that are in. So that,
correct.
That
House, kind of, running for the House again, yeah, incumbents in LD-17.
That kind of broke the mold. But that's where the split comes from. Not even talking about the Democrats. That's where the split comes in. And then you have people that said, well, and they still say it, well, 2020 was stolen. And they have the other half of the group said, yeah, well, 2020 is stolen. That water's gone over the dam, over the bridge, under the bridge. We've got an election to win in 2024.
Correct.
We can talk about this. I've had people tell me at meetings in the 22 election, if you don't fix the 2020 election, I'm not going to vote. And I scratched my head and I said, how does that help?
It doesn't.
It doesn't.
And of course, you guys have to run in the Arizona legislature every 2 years in both
every
the House
2 years.
And the Senate. Unlike, say, on the federal level where the House seats, like Juan's seat is every 2 years, but the senators get half a dozen here. Yeah. It's every 2 years. So you're basically perma running.
You always have to run. You get a little breather right after the election. Then you go into session. And then that summer, what typically be an off summer, you have to start campaigning, you have to start fundraising, because these campaigns are not $20 ventures anymore. When I started, you could do a district for about $40,000. I spent $76,000 in the primary, and I'll probably spend double of that in the general.
So well over $200,000 at this point to run for a Southern Arizona legislative district.
Southern Arizona, and if you go up in the valley, if you go up where J.D. Mesnard is, you will, and even Matt Grass, when you get out towards Paradise Valley, you will be seeing $1 million districts.
Unbelievable. This politics game isn't cheap over here, Vince.
No, it's
making the restaurant business seem like affordable. And,
no.
And that's saying something.
And We go, and there's no, I mean, we have clean elections funding, but clean elections funding has really gone by the wayside because the dollars that they offer are so minuscule compared to what you're forced to raise on the overall. It's cumbersome. Not many people are running clean elections. We call it running clean. But $1 million district for $24,000 a year and stale refried beans on Thursday night and reconstituted eggs in the morning. So
well, we appreciate your desire to serve, both your service that you've given us in the military and the Army, and of course serving, you know, as both a House representative and a senator. We've got one more segment with Senate candidate Vince Leach coming up after the break on Jump in Tucson. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. We are live with Senate candidate Vince Leach from Legislative District 17. He's got a little election coming up on November 5th. Vince, can you tell us about the importance of a Republican legislative majority?
You know, for the last 2 years that I served, we had a one-seat majority. And when you have a one-seat majority in both the Senate and the House, every member is a kingmaker. In other words, you have a bill going through and person A doesn't like that. It doesn't go through unless you fix that. In fact, we saw that on budgets the last 2 years that I was there. We had a segment of our Republican Party that didn't agree with the budget. And so the budget team, which I was on, and the House team, we all made the decision we're going to have to go across the aisle and work with the Democrats. Now, in some people, that caused a lot of consternation. But that was the fact that we have a constitutional duty to pass a balanced budget by the 1st of July. And so you've got to do that. Or you get into all funny things, shutting down government. That none of that is good. It's not good in the press, and it's not good for the people. And so you have this situation where there are times where you have to go across the aisle and you have to get the votes there. I mean, it happens on bills, but you would be surprised. Some 60, I didn't get this last year's yet, but 60 to 70% of the votes that come out, that go up to the governor's office, are bipartisan. About 16 or 17% of the votes that go through are unanimous. People don't see that. There are things that we agree on, and we say, yeah, that's a good bill. Why haven't we done that, da-da-da-da? And they just fly through. It's the issues. It's budget. It's K-12. It's school choice. And it's abortion. Those issues, at some degree, prisons. But those issues are the ones that cause all that get all the print in the papers. So
we talk a lot about K-12 education here in KVOI. Chris DeSimone, of course, brings it up quite a bit. What would happen, do you think, to ESAs if there's a Democrat majority in the House?
Probably, if they have a big enough majority to be passed on emergency, with emergency clause, that it would go into effect immediately. Otherwise, if they don't have the a supermajority, it would go into effect at the end of the year. It would take school choice away. And you're not only taking away ESAs, which seem to be the hot button, although I don't know if you saw our Department of Education came out and said, Department of Education is $4 billion to the good. We didn't spend everything that you gave us. So the ESA is bankrupting the education department. It's just false. But you're also getting rid of open enrollment from school district to school district. I don't know what it's going to do to STOs, which is a fantastic program. A lot of kids avail themselves of school tuition credits that they get. We actually work to get those, and we have a business portion of that that would go away. And so all kids just don't learn the same. They all learn differently. Parents will tell you, well, this child does this and this child does this. That shows right from the beginning, even before they get school age, that there's a difference in children. We should know that. We should avail ourselves of that difference, and we should give them every avenue to explore those possibilities and whatever education they see. And I've got a person in Oro Valley. I think she's got four boys. Well, now one has graduated, but I think they went to four different schools because that was their lifestyle. That was what they wanted. That would be a big, big, big mistake when every other state, almost every other state in the nation, is moving to school choice. More school choice, more school choice, more school choice.
Without a doubt. And Legislative District 17, the one at which you're running for, has been targeted by the Democrat Party as a potential seat to flip, either on the House or Senate side. And so have you reached out to Corey or to Rachel about this one? Are you guys campaigning together in the same way that Justine and
Rachel
and them did?
Corey and I was, this was a couple weeks after, well, not even that, maybe a week after the election. On a Saturday night, I'm sitting there watching either baseball or football and saying, you know what, self, we've got to talk. The three of us have got to talk sooner than later. And I got on the phone, I text him, and I said, we need to talk, and we need to talk sooner than later. And I'll call you back. Corey said, I'll call you back on Monday. I didn't have Rachel's phone number at that time. He called me back on Sunday. I said, okay, I'm leaving town on Tuesday for a little vacation. Can we meet Monday afternoon someplace? So we met at the coffee shop up on Tanga Verde. I always forget the name.
The Buzz?
No, there's another one up there. It keeps growing down the hill. But anyway, so we met there, just the three of us. No campaign consultants, no press people. Just the three of us talking, and we talked about, you know, going forward. We need, and I've said this from the podium, so I'm not giving you breaking news. I've said this from the podium in Saddlebrook. I've said it in Saddlebrook Ranch. I've said it at the PC meeting. We need all three of us to be elected. We need Rachel elected. We need Corey elected. And we need to get myself elected. We need to hold those majorities. And the Democrats are coming after us. My opponent has about $147,000 that he's advertising. Rachel and Corey's opponent is advertising $250,000.
No, these are big elections coming up. Where can our listeners find out more information about you, Senate candidate Vince Leach?
So they can find out all about me at Vince Leach for Senate. Spelled it out, F-O-R, for Senate.com. Position papers are on there. There's a position, and I will give out my public phone number. Because everybody else in 17 and the old 11 have it, 520-818-8814, 520-818-8814. Call me if you want to. I was on the phone in the parking lot with a concern, people I know on a housing issue, but call and The beauty of having somebody with experience going in is I know people. I may not be able to get done, but I know a Grant. I know a Chris. I know somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody that could get the job done or at least move the needle in the right direction.
Well, there you go. That's Vince Leach's cell phone number out there for you listeners, showing he is wide open to listen to his constituency. He's got a big race coming up. Ballots are mailed out on, I want to say, October 9th it is?
October 9th.
And so election month is coming up at September 11th. We're not that far away.
When that ballot hits, vote your ballot, take it in, and mail it. If you don't want to take it in, find out where you have a poll place to drop it. In Saddlebrook, they're actually bringing, they have a van up there run by the county election. They're going to bring it out, and they can drop ballots there. Get those ballots in. Don't wait for the 7th of November to say, oh my God, We got to get our early ballots in.
You're hearing it from Senate candidate Vince Leach. Vince, it's been an amazing morning. Thank you for joining us on Jump in Tucson. Listeners, thank you again for spending part of your Wednesday morning with us. Lots we've got to do together over here in Southern Arizona to get this done for the election. Have a great day out there, listeners. Let's roll.